data's greatest.
Corey Pippen, UFO Show.
I could, but it would probably take a whole lot of time. The reason I state that, when I got out in 1989, we had cataloged 57 different species. You have individuals that look very much like you and myself that could walk among us and you wouldn't even notice the difference, except for some of the things that they might be able to go ahead, even in a dark room, and touch an object and go ahead and identify what color that object might be. They would have a heightened sense of smell, sight, hearing. The situation is that you have various types of what we normally call grays. We didn't call them grays in the military, but you had at least three types of the grays. You had some that were much taller than we were. The unique thing that I'd like to point out for the most part is that the entities that we did catalog were in fact humanoid. Now this created a situation where the scientific community was trying to figure out why that would be the case, because you would expect that if life evolved on other planets that they would take on some type of other being, so to speak, not necessarily look humanoid or be bipedal such as we are. But apparently we got quite a few of the species out there that are humanoid in appearance. And that creates a question that yet has to be answered by science.
That was U.S. Army Sergeant retired Clifford Stone, who lives in Roswell, at a news conference talking about extraterrestrials and his experience in a top secret organization, a unit that he was in when he was on active duty. Clifford Stone is only one of many researchers in the UFO field that actually live in Roswell. And we're coming up on the 4th of July, and this time it will be, are you ready for this? It's almost amazing. But it is amazing. There's nothing about it. It's almost. 64 years ago, the Roswell UFO crash occurred over the 4th of July during the heart of a thunderstorm. Since then, Roswell has gone through several reincarnations, a series of curiosity and spotlight back in the news days when it was first released from 47, then the UFO collapse in 52, then it almost went away, the UFO issue completely, until Stanton Friedman rediscovered it in the 70s when he happened to be in, of all places, Louisiana doing a television show and found out about Jesse Marcel, the public information officer at the Roswell Army Air Force Base at the time of the crash. And since Stanton wrote about that and started doing his research, several others have come along and done very well as well with some great research. Dennis Malthuser, for instance, Don Smith, Tom Carey. We could go on and list those. Lots of people live in Roswell, as I mentioned, that are interested in UFOs. And it all comes to center stage every year over the 4th of July, thanks to recent efforts, really, that were kind of reincarnated back in the 50th anniversary, and for the 15 years since then, almost, well, 14 years, Roswell has gone all out for a festival in which it became a family affair under the previous mayor. And before that, they, of course, had UFO festivals as well. But it was really developed by the city in the last 4 or 5 years. There has been some friction, and we'll discuss that in a minute. I don't want to get into too much internal baseball here on this show, But I think some things need to be clarified and straightened out, and we'll do that later in the show. But right now, let's talk about something, is positive. First of all, Clifford Stone, in an interview that he did with me in Roswell, will be featured later in the show, so stay tuned for that. The positive thing is that right now, the International Roswell Sci-Fi Film Festival is underway. And it's a big event, and it's being held at various places, but basically the big part of the event is July 2nd at the Pearson Auditorium. And it's been the work of some of these people to really put this together. And I wanted to mention this at the top of the show while we're talking about positive things about Roswell. Because this film festival is something to behold. And it has all kinds of things that are important to me, and I would assume to you. And one of those things is that it's actually an educational endeavor in which filmmakers around the world were invited to Roswell to attend a boot camp. And the boot camp went on for the month of June, almost, I think it lasted a full 30 days. I'm not sure. You can go over there and check on the website, which I'll give you here in a moment, to let you figure that out completely. But they had this boot camp in which they really discussed several things and did lessons and seminars and actual practical hands-on experience and on how to make films, how to make movies, but not only just how to make them, but also how to distribute them. And basically this month-long boot camp had seminars on casting, on shooting, directing, editing, and, of course, how to get your film out in the public, in the arena, so people can see it. And, I actually had several things going on in this boot camp. One of the major things, of course, was the $1,500 grant they gave to one of the winners. They also gave away some state-of-the-art film equipment to others. Now, the film will actually premiere, along with some ceremonies, in a big red carpet event on July 2nd at 7 p.m. at the New Mexico Pearson Auditorium in Roswell. And the Pearson Auditorium has undergone renovation, and it's really a place to behold. So if you're going to be in Roswell at all, I think I would put this on my calendar, July 2nd, 7 to 9 p.m. The ticket is $25. It goes for a good cause because they're going to do this every year, this Roswell Sci-Fi Film Festival. And the major part, as I just alluded to, of course, is the boot camp that goes on before the festival. So that's at the Pearson Auditorium, Sunday, July 2nd. And if you want to get some information on how to get the tickets and things, there's a website, which we'll give to you here in a moment. But first of all, I want to go ahead and flush out what else is happening. There's some free things going on as well. The sci-fi independent films are being screened at the Roswell Museum and Arts Center. The free screenings will be held on June 30th through July 2nd. And they go on constantly between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. So you have some free things to go to as well if you go to Roswell. Now, for more information about this, I'd recommend that you go to the website that they have and check it out. It's called filmroswell.com. Filmroswell, all one word, filmroswell.com. So that's the positive thing about Roswell this year. We're going to get to some of the other things about Roswell and also about other events concerning UFOs and some of the I don't know how to really describe what I'm going to say, so I'll just say it. There seems to be some organized disruption of UFO credibility and news. And I think it started with Annie Jacobson and her book on Area 51 when she did the outlandish thing of talking about something that was impossible, and that was that the Roswell crash involved teenage mutants developed by Joseph Mengele in connection with Joseph Stalin, and somehow they got these teenage mutants to pilot this craft, this flying disc, which the Soviets did get the information from the Nazis, and the Nazis did develop a flying disc in the 1930s, but for it to have flown all the way from Russia to Roswell during a thunderstorm, and they could get the teenage mutants who were deformed horribly to look like ETs developed by Joseph Mengele, it stretches the imagination. And so that's one phase. That had to be some sort of orchestrated disinformation, something to throw out there in the mix when all the TV interviewers interviewed this author, and they'd be talking to her about Area 51 and what goes on there, and the best way to discount and get them off of the subject of alien involvement, alien back engineering, ET bases, things like that, is to throw out this incredible story, which anyone would have to dismiss, especially if you took a look at Dr. Mengele. He actually didn't get his medical license in 1938. I don't think he became a Nazi until 1939. And the Roswell crash happened in 1947. Well, that means those teenage mutants would probably not have even been teenagers. They'd been 10 years old. And you're telling me they flew that craft? So that's one phase of the disinformation. The other phase is the trouble at MUFON. And I want to get into that here briefly. And then I want to get back to Roswell. Okay, let's talk about MUFON for a little bit. And this organization's been around for a long, long time. And we have worked with them off and on forever. And as you know, if you've been listening to our shows at all, and probably, unless you live, in a cave someplace, maybe in Dulce, underneath the mesa, there's been some discourse, some unhappiness about the fact that MUFON and some of its state directors have been fired. There have been things about disclosure agreements and whether or not they really happen, about the Bigelow incident in which Bigelow Aerospace and its companies paid over $300,000 in cash to MUFON for access to their database. Been a lot of rumblings about MUFON and the database. We have done some shows on it, and we've been surprised that many of the people who spoke up in favor of MUFON are no longer there. I mean, there seems to be some internal discourse, and we talked to Clifford Cliff by email yesterday about some of this. And he says there's no such thing as a non-disclosure. That's not what we hear from other people. We'll follow that up here on a separate show about MUFON. But I wanted to just discuss the idea that all of these things happening in MUFON, maybe there's a reason for it. Just like all of the things happening down in Roswell, which we'll get back to it here in a moment, it's almost like somebody's trying to disrupt everything and make sure nobody has any credibility, and that when it comes to the UFO issues, it appears that everybody's at each other's throats and nobody's really talking about real facts and real things, and we have these huge ideas. Some of them we've even presented on our show. And I want to talk about that for a minute. We do bring on all kinds of people talking about all aspects of UFOs. And that does not mean that the Jerry Pippin Show or me, Jerry Pippin, personally endorse any of these people. Our charter, our idea about doing shows, not only about UFOs, but about politics, about conspiracies, about whatever, is to present what's out there. In other words, give the people who are making these presentations of certain facts, to give them a forum to present their best efforts so that you and I can make up our own minds about what is the truth and what is not. Now, this is the problem with MUFON right now, in my opinion. They are being far, far too secretive about some of the things they're doing, and that's not what MUFON was designed for. Now, all of a sudden, I get this note that the MUFON will be asking its members to make a choice between being a member of MUFON or a member of EPIC. You know what EPIC is? That's Ken Cherry's organization, and they do deal with paranormal subjects. But so what? Why would MUFON have the ability to tell anyone that's a volunteer what they can do and what they can't do? But they seem to be doing that regularly, and we'll talk about that in detail. As I said, I didn't want to really do another show on MUFON at all, because really it's up to the members. This is a huge organization. It's worldwide. The members should have access to, doing whatever they can for their own organization, or leave it, or reform it from the inside, which is the way I like to work. But evidently, there seems to be a lot of friction going on, and a lot of chatter, a lot of upset attitudes, but nobody's really coming forward with alternatives for the membership. And we'll do a show about that in detail. But I want to address a couple of things here. First of all, the Bigelow incident, where they had access to the database. There was some discussion whether or not Bigelow was going to just shut that down and not allow anybody else to see it. Now, that contract's long since gone. But whatever gave the board of directors or anybody at Bigelow, at MUFON, I should say, the right to give anybody, including Bigelow, even if he did pay a huge sum of money, $300,000 or more, to the right to that database? It belongs to the public. It was formed by people who were volunteers, and so the database should be accessible to all. Now, Clifford Cliff says there's no disclosure agreement, non-disclosure agreement. I don't know. That's not what I've heard from other people, and we'll talk more about that. The thing that came up this last week, and I want to bring out publicly, is the fact that MUFON has been trying is shopping, and I see nothing wrong with this. And Clifford Cliff confirmed this to me in an email yesterday. Basically, they've been looking and talking to Hollywood television people, not necessarily just Hollywood, about doing a MUFON series. I think that would be wonderful. I think it would be a great public access show. By that, I mean access to prime time, not on a public cable TV channel. I'm talking about like what one of those shows, like some of the game shows and things like that, that butt up against prime time and is syndicated by the local stations. I think it'd be a great vehicle. Also be a good vehicle for cable TV. The MUFON cases and the database. But I just am wondering if they have the right at MUFON to sell this to a TV documentary producer. If they don't make it public, and if they don't use the money for the operation of MUFON, obviously it needs money to operate. They do charge for memberships. You get that magazine and all of that. But basically, it seems to me the problem of MUFON is that there seems to be a troublemaker somewhere. Now, James Carrion, the former international director, told me on the air, and you'll remember that show, and it's still available at jerrypippin.com. And basically, that he said that there was a mole, somebody on the board of directors at MUFON who was, working with the government to cause disruption. Now, Clifford Cliff said, what's wrong with him getting a TV deal? Clifford, absolutely nothing's wrong with that. I think it's great. I wish you success with that. The only thing I'm finding that I'm questioning, and I'm not ready to come out and make a complete statement about it yet, but that is the fact that MUFON uses volunteers. The mission was public information about UFOs, and if we're holding up information and not making the database available to everybody, then what's this all about? Now, there's another question about the board of directors and who can select them and whether or not it'll violate their nonprofit charter if they change it and all of that BS. Of course it won't. You can change anything as long as you stay with IRS rules. And it seems to me the board of directors should be subject to the membership. It should be approved by vote rather than the board of directors voting on board of directors. That doesn't seem to be very fair. But basically, my point on this show is that somebody or some organization, and probably it's located in the Pentagon, I'm not sure, they're disrupting all of this and causing trouble. And there's lots of trouble going on down in Roswell, and we'll talk about that next.
And one of this year's big events was supposed to be a nighttime UFO light parade.
The night parade, Lights Over Roswell parade, is also being canceled. Again, we refuse to have an event that would be a disappointment.
The problem with the parade is only a few people showed an interest.
We'll try it again next year and maybe have a little better luck and more time to get people working on them.
Now, that's part of a newscast that was on Channel 4 KOB in Albuquerque, arguably the most watched station in New Mexico, about Roswell and what's going on this year. And that was Julie Schuessler talking about them canceling the parade. Now, I've been to Roswell for many years. I've attended about seven of those things. And some of those parades did suck. You couldn't really see too much, and there wasn't much in it. But evidently, they had at least three floats that were quite well. One of them was by a bank, and after the news came out they canceled the parade, the bank did something pretty clever on Friday. They demolished their float right in front of the bank. It made it look like a UFO crash. Evidently, it was a UFO itself. So people in Roswell are taking this in stride. But there is a reason for the parade being canceled. And it's not the reason given officially here on KKOB. KOB, the radio station's KKOB. This is a television station. Listen to the reporter.
The UFO Museum agreed to run the festival this year because of several internal problems and the resignation of last year's festival committee chairperson.
We want the people that are involved to be proud of it, and we want to be proud of it, and we want Roswell to be proud of it.
A barbecue cooking competition has been canceled due to conflicts with two other events that same weekend in Rio Rancho and Ruidoso.
The fact that the city chairman resigned, and that's the reason they're having all these problems, is bogus. Julie Schuessler knows better. She's the one that was instrumental in getting Rene Roach to leave. I have been broadcasting from Roswell for many years, and when the city picked it up and they hired the Rick Johnson Agency, advertising agency, They paid me a production fee to come there. So I want to make that clear, and I want to be transparent. Because I did get money for advertising and promotion. I never really got enough to cover my expenses all the way. But the point was, they spent some of that money, and the money came from the lodging tax. Now, there had been a big push in the election with Mayor Journey, who won by only about 200 votes over the previous mayor. And there's lots of questions about that, which there's no room for on a UFO show. But I've always found that vote total very, very suspicious. But anyway, basically, Mayor Journey was inclined and predisposed to privatize and give the lodging tax stipend that was used by the city of Roswell every year to promote this thing, give it to the UFO Museum and turn everything over to them. Well, the city got involved in it to begin with because the museum really wasn't doing, in my opinion, a proper job of promoting. And this year they got $150,000 and they did not spend it. They haven't spent it yet. At the end of that report, it says it's under budget. Well, I understand it's really under budget. They haven't touched any of the money. Now, so the parade and advertising and news comes from, like, the Holiday Inn Express says they're only about half full for this year. Some of the other hotels are full, but many of them are not. And the reason is because there's not been enough pre-promotion. Now, they're trying to prove some sort of point, and I don't know what it is. And this gets back to my original thoughts here on the opening of the show. What in the world is going on in the UFO community that we have this mass confusion, obfuscation, people not getting along with each other, total anger? I've never seen some of the misinformation and hurt feelings and everything that have been going on, not only in Roswell, but with MUFON and with everything. And with Annie Jacobson and her outlandish story about Area 51. Is this some sort of new tack to kind of stave off things? Let's get back to Roswell here for a minute. And I want to throw one thought out to you, and one thought only, and that is, it's been 64 years, and it's still top secret. Why? The Cold War's gone? All our old enemies are gone? The terrorists are busy riding camels, not UFOs. What's going on here? Why is it still secret? And why do we have all of this stuff going on with the major worldwide UFO volunteer organization on sightings and investigations in disarray, MUFON? Roswell has been a catfight for years now. It's an unbelievable situation down there. And this year, it's coming home to roost. Only about a half occupancy so far. And the will everybody show up? I think you must be aware, folks, that the celebration's going on. And so if you're inclined to go to Roswell, please go ahead and go. There's been a huge effort to lay this off on poor attendance this year by the UFO Museum and others who push for this privatization. Well, the economy's poor. Hey, I've been there when it was $4 a gallon plus for gasoline, and the economy was nowhere. In 2008, we lost half of our value in all of our investments and in banking, and they had big crowds and sellouts. So that's bogus. And now for Julie Schuessler to lay this off on public, on television, on the number one television station in New Mexico, that it's because Renee Roach quit or resigned when she was under unbelievable pressure. Unbelievable pressure. I was there. I know about it. And no one No one in public relations has done a better job than Renee Roach. She has, Roberta Scott, who's in public relations with us, one of our producers, and she has a huge state job here in Oklahoma. Roberta Scott marvels at Renee Roach because Roberta calls her a superwoman. And she is. She got major television shows to come to Roswell and check everything out and do broadcasts from there. The hotels were sold out a month before. They took care of all of the details. And this year, for them to not spend the money, but take it off the market and make sure that Roswell fails and brings down some businessmen with it. The small businesses in downtown Roswell are all built around the UFO theme. Is unbelievable. Now, there are things still going on. The museum will still be open. They do have an array of speakers. Noy Torres is not going this year, but E.J. Wilson, who lives in Roswell, is still doing those walking tours out at the Army Air Force Base. And I've been on that walking tour, and it's something really worthwhile. If you want to find information about that, to go to RoswellTours.com and check that out. They're not buying any advertising from me. It's just a one-man operation. But he's doing a great job. You walk through this 10 points of what happened at the night of the 4th of July and subsequent days on how they shipped out the bodies, how they shipped out the wreckage, what they did with everybody, who went where. And they pointed out, as you see, the buildings. And it's an incredible, incredible tour. And E.J. Wilson's doing a great job with that. Now, you can find him down at Roswell Landing signing his books along with a few other authors. And I would recommend Roswell Landing. And also, Planet Roswell will be there, too. They tried to do some stuff this year, and they were forwarded by the city every time they turned around. Why does the UFO Museum get $150,000 and these other merchants get nothing? So, my thesis, my hypothesis here, is something else might be going on. Or can all of this disarray and MUFON in Roswell and all the other subjects, I mean, they're even having trouble over Rendlesham Forest, for God's sake, and all of those things in the UK. Is this by design to keep you and me from knowing the truth about UFOs? We'll be back in a moment with our show. You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love, a gift of life to that stray dog or cat. Welcome to another Roswell show, and we have a man who's a legend in Roswell, Clifford Stone. Most people refer to you as Sergeant Clifford Stone, and you were retired. You served 20 years or what?
22 and a half years, sir.
In what?
in the United States Army, sir.
And we'll talk a little bit about your book, but before we get to that, it's a pleasure meeting you because I've read some of your stuff and a lot of people have talked about it, and now we're going to get to find out firsthand.
Thank you, sir.
And you told Dennis Balthaser, we were talking about subterranean bases, you say you have some plans, huh?
Oh, yes, sir.
Tell me a little bit about that. How did you come about that?
Oh.
Or can you tell me?
Well, I have a whole lot of documentation.
Yeah, I know that. That's what I'm getting to.
I visit a lot of government sites.
Uh-huh.
And I'm fortunate that a lot of the things that people don't even know where to go to look, I know where to look. So I have all kinds of information. If I start talking about antimatter drive, people say, oh, you saw Star Trek once too often. Yet we are actually working on antimatter drives.
Mm-hmm.
And people aren't aware of that. A lot of people aren't aware of the fact that there was feasibility studies on what they call advanced propulsion systems. And that was sponsored by the United States Air Force Research Laboratories. And they actually have a manual out about talking about traversing wormholes using antimatter drives, warp speed.
Wow.
And there's even another feasibility study out that talks about teleportation and the feasibility of doing that. Now, they say it's not within the near future, but I would suggest that a lot of things that wasn't in the near future 20 years ago, they're here now. We look, the Air Force does studies saying, okay, where are we going to be, say, 50 years from now? They did one such study in 1945, and they missed out because a lot of things they said, which was really fantastic back then, we have surpassed. They did a study in 1995. Actually, they did two studies, Air Force 2025, which is where are we going to be 30 years down the road, and that was done in 95. And the other study was done by the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board, where are we going to be in the year 2045, 50 years down the road. Both those reports dealt with existing technologies and how we were going to exploit them. For example, can you imagine an aircraft taking off from an airfield, having no fuel on it, synthesizing that its fuel.
Manufacturing it as it
goes along. Yes, sir. And if you get a puncture, don't worry about it. It will go ahead and heal itself.
Hmm.
And these are things that we're actually working on today.
Yeah, well, I've heard terms like living metal and things like that, so that's probably along that line.
And, well, I believe, I don't believe mankind is not capable of doing things, thinking and coming up with ideas and thoughts and formulating those thoughts into the technologies that we have. But I do believe that some of the technologies got a kickstart because of things that we have recovered. If I was in California right now and I was sitting with some friends of mine, we'd be talking about, you know, as everyone should know it, of course, it would all be classified. We'd be talking about things like, gee, okay, we got this, but how did it get started? There had to be that vision. It's like we had a fantastic program, which I'm really enthusiastic about. We just released a CD with it. There's pictures of it, too, there. But it was called Project Dinosaur.
Tell me a little bit about that. You and I talked about that on the phone.
Project Dinosaur actually got its start in Germany during the war. They were working on a method of getting a rocket into space to come over here and say hello to us. They had some fireworks they wanted to deliver to us here in the 48 states that are adjacent. So they were working on this. Fortunately for us, the war ended before that happened. Fortunately for us, we got the plans and the technology that they had already developed before our adversaries did. We very enthusiastically started to hit up on the program by 1954-55 time frame. We had technical reports on how we could do it. Money stopped us from doing it. But the first project that they were hitting up on was a lenticular or saucer-shaped craft. that we were going to put out in space. It'd be out there for several weeks to several months, have a crew of 4 to 6 people. In the event of war, they could launch missiles or drop bombs from out in space, and no one could do anything to stop that. There's still not a whole lot that's been released on that particular program. It's known as the Langley Lenticular Lifting Vehicle. I'm still trying to get information, more information on it. The other one was like a wedge-shaped UFO. A wedge shape. Now, the interesting thing about the wedge shape, there was a photograph taken in 1947 in Arizona that the FBI went to visit the man, talked to him about it. He took a CIC agent who later became an OSI agent, CIC meaning Counterintelligence Corps, mm-hmm. OSI, Office of Special Investigations, the equivalent of the FBI and the U.S. Yeah. Air Force. The CIC person wanted the photographs with the original negatives. The gentleman in question went ahead and said, okay, I'll bring them over to the FBI headquarters tomorrow. When the FBI agent and CIC agent left the gentleman's home, the CIC agent, or the FBI agent, turned to the CIC agent and says, hey, you know, he asked you if he's going to get those back. You didn't answer him. Is he going to get them back? The CIC agent said emphatically, probably not. This is a matter of national security. Those pictures never made it to Blue Book. They were taken to the Pentagon. They stayed there at the Pentagon until the gentleman asked for them back because he was going to release them and let True Magazine use them for an article. When he wrote to the Air Force saying, hey, you guys have my pictures, I was wondering, can I get them back? Ruppelt said, this guy's just trying to jump on the bandwagon. We have no report. We have no pictures. Well, a colonel from the Pentagon said, yeah, we do. They're in one of two classified files that we have here at Air Intelligence. By the way, Captain, you should go ahead and write a letter of apology for us not getting those back to him. And we believe them to be a hoax. He never did get his original prints back. Mm-hmm. He never did get his original negatives back. This is crucial. The negatives he could have taken in, had them test them, and really destroyed the Air Force's conclusion that they were hoax photographs. To this day, I do not believe them to be hoax. Also, the crash that occurred here, people are referring to it as being like a hill shape or wedge shape UFO that was recovered. What I'm suggesting here is that the early UFO reports sparked the imagination of many people that were involved in the air industry at the time, and they saw a technology there that could be utilized. And they went to work on it. That's why they were very enthusiastic about Dinosaur. What I'm pretty certain of is that some of the technology that may have been involved is technology that we exploited that came from someplace else. Now, the reason I state that, if I mention to you the U-2 plane, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Sure.
If I mention to you the SR-71... Mm-hmm. You know exactly what I'm talking about. If I go up and say Dinosaur, then you, oh yeah, I know about those. About 60 million years ago, they were on the Earth.
That's what I said to you on the phone. I didn't know they were in there.
And well, this is one of the states that has a lot of fossils.
Yeah, I know.
But the whole situation is that program was more viable than either one of the two programs that I just mentioned, the U-2 or the SR-71.
And they're both real.
And, of course, most people think, well, Dinosaur never flew. Oh, yes, it did. It went out in space, but it would not be until 1961 the first flight was be taken. December 12, 1963, they killed the program. Here again, lack of funds, and we had this silliness looming on the horizon we called the Vietnam War. So we went ahead and decided that we were going to go ahead, go to war, and put all our money in there and put all of our trust in the U-2 and the SR-71, which were very good aircraft. And they killed any more research on Dinosaur, or so they say. I honestly believe that Dinosaur lived on. and it's more sophisticated than anybody knows, and I honestly believe today dinosaurs still flying, and it can do very marvelous things.
Like, for instance, what? I mean, we're thinking about 48 people out in space, and we don't know about it.
Well, I'm going to...
one thing.
Yes, sir. But I'm talking about in the near envelope of the Earth's atmosphere also. In the October 1973 war, I was told a story by an Egyptian colonel. If it's all right with you, I don't want to disclose where that was told. He knows where it was disclosed. He's heard the story.
Talking about your friend.
Yes, sir. But when Israel was about to collapse, when they were invaded October 6, 1973, by the elements of the Egyptian army and the Syrian army, they were about to collapse. The Air Force, that the Israelite Air Force could not go in, neutralized the tanks and the infantry that was on the ground. And that was thanks to the surface-to-air shoulder-fired missiles to take down the aircraft. He told me that they knew it was U.S. aircraft. About four of them showed up. Very weird-looking aircraft. Now, at the time, I was thinking F-111s with their wings back. And he said that they just started to do a loop, a circle in the air. They would fire their shoulder-fired missiles up at these planes. They would get up so high and that they'd just fall to the ground. Well, when they fall to the ground, you still expect them to explode. They didn't explode. This enabled the Israelite Air Force to neutralize the threat that was about to end the existence of Israel. The U.S. to this day denies that ever occurred. But I got it firsthand when I said, I think I know the aircraft. I was actually told, you know, you stay in your office and you don't bring it up no more. Do not bring the book in. Well, they shouldn't have been worried because at that time, the term, and this was, by the way, 1984.
Okay.
The term was still classified. Dinosaur was still classified. Somebody went ahead and thought it'd be cute to go ahead and put dinosaur on a T-shirt and a spacecraft there. And the United States government actually went and rounded up all those T-shirts because it was a name that no one was supposed to know. Now, remember, it was killed in 63. Yes, sir. So, and some of the documents on that CD that I gave you were just declassified this year, March 17th. And
Now this CD is available.
Oh, yes, sir.
And... can you give me an example of some of those classified documents? What do they say? Backing up your story or what?
Oh, yeah, well, yes, sir, except for what happened there in Israel. One guy actually, I think, knew a little bit about it in one of the histories that was written because he was talking about how if we had dinosaur at the time of that attack, it would have made things so much easier for the Israelites. Well, I think we did have dinosaur at that time because we had no space-based assets and we weren't flying U-2s or SR-71s over the specific area of the Mediterranean where the Soviet Navy had taken up position to go in and reinforce Syria and Egypt and assist in the occupation of Israel. Every unit at that time, I remember it well because I was still in the military. As a matter of fact, I was sent greetings and salutations. I'd been a fun-loving civilian for 28 days. And now I found myself back in the uniform asking myself, what am I doing here? But I was back, and this was going on. And if you remember, we also had the a major flap, UFO flap in October 73. But the big concern was what the Russians were going to do. And the reason we knew about it was...
the Russian threat was real at
point,
and we had a major UFO flap. Are you saying there was a connection there? Or just a coincidence?
Well, I think there was a connection there. I think that our visitors are very interested in some of the things we do. We were on the brink at that time of... total annihilation, because had we got into it with the Russians at that time, or the Soviet Union, it would have ultimately led to a nuclear exchange. And I am of the belief that Israel will not just let herself fall. She will destroy herself, and I mean with nuclear weapons. I believe Israel does have a nuclear weapons. They would use them. They will fall on their own sword before they will capitulate to any other nation.
And the extraterrestrial involvement is to stop it or watch it or monitor it or what?
This is our planet. They're going to let us do whatever we want to do. I firmly believe we are also a nation in our planet in quarantine.
You're a sergeant first class, right?
Yes, sir.
And retired.
Yes, sir.
And you obviously had a pretty high clearance because you've seen a lot of things.
Well, the interesting thing about the clearance is that I wanted to apply for a clearance because I felt I needed it in order for promotions. First attempt was there in Germany. And I had a SPO sergeant. That SPO is SPO's security plans and operations. No. If you do that, they'll keep you quiet. And I was able to talk pretty much freely on UFOs at that time. It didn't get me in trouble until I got here.
Here in Roswell?
Yes, sir. And I almost got court-martialed. I was getting calls.
You were still in the service?
Yes, sir. And one thing I don't want to talk about is I was more involved in what I'm saying here.
Okay.
But there was a reason. I mean, I'm a 71 Lima, and they send me to Roswell, New Mexico, after requesting that I put in my request to go to the Sinai Desert to be on the multinational
force.
Right. Oh, yes, sir. But they call, no, you're going to Roswell. And I'm sitting, what's at Roswell? And I've been back in the States for about 2.5 years, 3 years. Normally you're ready to go overseas. Well, they were sending me to the New Mexico Military Institute.
Well, that's right down the street.
Yes, sir. And I was with the Military Science Department there. It wound up that when I got there, I was getting calls from various agencies dealing with UFOs. I even talked to some groups here reference UFOs, and some of the powers that be did not like that. My life became a living nightmare, and I thought some of the folks that I dealt with had forgotten me. Well, they didn't. Ultimately, I wound up, I got relieved of duty. I was isolated, essentially not being able to do anything. Put into a room where I stayed except to go get lunch. But then I was exonerated. And after being relieved of duty, getting an adverse EER, one of the highest peacetime awards you can get for service, I was awarded that, the Meritorious Service Medal.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I have the distinction of being the only service member, living or dead, that got a medal for service during a time he was relieved for duty and got an adverse EER.
Yeah, that's hard to believe, but at the same time, things like that happen.
Oh, yes, sir. The other thing was hard to believe. Here it was. I was going to Germany. The family was here, and I needed to take a leave, and I requested a 30-day leave so I could move my family actually back to Mississippi. We had a home there. And
by Fort Jackson?
Keesler Air Force Base.
Okay.
I had some interesting assignments. But I went ahead and I said, well, I need to get my family back there. And, well, no, you can't do that. And they held me and held me and held me. 3 days before I was to go to Germany, I was given leave. Didn't give me no time to do anything. So we're buying the house where we're at right now here, so we stayed there. I went to Germany. When I went to Germany, I got a letter from 4th ROTC region granting me the 30 days leave. Like, what am I going to do about it now? Also, where my assignment was supposed to be, it didn't turn out to be where I was supposed to be going. And I found that I was going to be back involved with the non-existent issue of UFOs. So the people who really control that, whether you're military or the alphabet soup of the military intelligence, no one knows who that small nucleus is that controls it. So I figured if I put in my request for retirement, I will be able to go ahead, retire, and they won't be any the wiser. So I went ahead after being there for about six months in Germany, and we started to have things happening in Belgium. We had things going on in the...
talking about in the UFO world.
Yes, sir.
You're right.
In the Soviet Union. Soviet Union lost a fighter, MiG-27. In the summer. We were able to keep that quiet for 72 hours, and it never broke over here. Things got really hot for the pilot. He bailed out. Then the plane regained power, and it crashed in Belgium. But UFOs, along with their occupants, was being seen in Russia even. And we were actually...
When you say their occupants, what were you talking about there?
Well, there were several different types of occupants.
Okay.
You had your classical grays. You had some that looked like inflated balloons, like you might say, about 10 foot tall, that would just float. It didn't look like they were walking or anything like that, but they would float, and they would go up over fences, things of this sort, the whole school saw them. Their military was concerned about some of the things. As a matter of fact, there was a recent release of a CIA document that makes reference to a pilot being killed in 1989. There were other things that have happened, and I think those documents have come out where the CIA was making reference to them also, where the military officials of the Soviet Union was alluding to, yes, we have our own problems with UFOs. And the one thing that I didn't want to be involved with was being in Germany for 4 years and the family not being there. So I said I was going to take leave, went in, put in my retirement, didn't utter a word to the powers that be on the other side of the fence. October 30th, I took leave, October 30th, 1989. Came back November 30th, I was to report to Fort Bliss to out-process and complete my retirement. I got to Fort Bliss, and they attached me for 60 days, pending approval of my retirement. The only problem was the retirement had already been approved. They had to revoke those orders, which you're not supposed to do that unless it's in time of war or you're on a by-name listing that says, we need you and you're staying. It'd be very, very difficult to state that they needed me to be in a 71 Lima. Of course, there were other things that I was doing, and they were short of people. What I was doing along in the UFO field at that time, and I'll say reluctantly because it was, they went ahead and thought they were going to keep me, but I went ahead, and if they called my bluff, I would have still been in the Army for about another 10 years.
You don't want to tell me what that reluctant job was? Okay. Now I'll let you off.
It ties in. It gets me in trouble when I talk about it a lot.
Well, I don't want to get you in a lot of trouble on the first show.
Well, I'll tell you something else. When you deal with it up close and personal, it really isolates you. And the only reason I started to talk about it was I had a personal tragedy that occurred, and I felt that my family needed to know what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I told them first. Then I told some other people, and some other people told other people. And you get to the point where, gee, if I could just go back and deny this, but you can't, because to deny it, you're denying yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it. I know what I went through. I lived it. And I actually started to check, gee, can you prove any of this? And I have a CD at home called Stoney's File, where I try to piece some things together. And there's circumstantial evidence. In several military publications, my conviction that UFOs are real, they were put out there for a purpose because we knew something was going to happen in Europe. They were put out in October, November of 1980. And you might recall what happened at Rendlesham Field in December of 1980. There's still more to that story that needs to be told.
Tell our audience a little bit, because a lot of people don't.
Over the course of several nights, between the 26th and the 29th, at Rendlesham Field there in England.
We've done shows on it, but a lot of
there were UFO sightings that was taking place. There are allegations that there were landings and that there were entities that got out of these craft once they landed. Military personnel were involved. The military personnel saw these entities. Most are reluctant to talk. Some are coming out talking, which is a good thing. Some people are stopping short, and I understand why, that have knowledge that the entities were there in high places, who are coming out and talking, well, yeah, we saw these and nothing really ever happened to me. The military didn't come after me or anything like that. And as long as you don't talk about seeing the entities, they're not going to come after you. You just saw lights. You saw lights in the forest. But now people are becoming more and more brazen. They're coming out and stating that they saw a structured craft. And we're not talking just the privates and the sergeants, but
yeah,
we have officers.
Yeah, I think there was either a lieutenant colonel or a colonel.
Lieutenant colonel.
Right. Was involved in that.
Yes, sir.
That's about as high as a field grade officer you can get. So.
Well, he went on to make colonel.
Yes, so he didn't hurt his reputation. Or we don't know. He may have made general otherwise.
But he's coming out and he's talking more. But what I'd like to see is for more, what I'd like to see is the documentation that I know is there come out. When we
got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about that. Sergeant Clifford Stone is our guest, and we'll talk about the DVDs and his book and a few other things. As you can tell, it's a very interesting hour. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin. We're in Roswell.
The doors are finally open at ShopJerryPippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition t-shirt selections features three different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector t-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at ShopJerryPippin.com.
We are broadcasting from the Earth Station Roswell Visitor Center. Sergeant Clifford Stone, the E, Clifford E. Stone. What's the E stand for?
Earl.
Okay, Earl. Well, you said you knew where to look sometimes. In other words, your experience, and we're talking about documentation.
Yes, sir.
And documents, period. I got from that, and maybe I'm putting your words in your mouth or something, but I got from that, if you knew where they were and you asked properly or showed up and said, let me see it, usually they'd let you do it.
They would usually let me do it. As a matter of fact, in Dinosaur, I got to see the documents before they were declassified. And I'm sitting back looking at them and seeing that they're still stamped with their classification. And I'm saying, well, where's the stamp that says that these have been declassified under FOIA?
And it's not there yet.
And, it's not there. It's not been declassified yet. I said, so if somebody sees me at these, I just simply tell them to call you. And no, you're going to go to jail because they're not declassified. And I said, okay, what do I need to do to get them declassified? Well, eventually they were declassified, put up on site. Some of the stuff I was trying to get from Wright-Patterson, they made it very difficult because my computer would keep going down. And even though it had the program in there to open the files, it wouldn't open them. And a friend of mine in California, he went ahead emailed them to me. So I got them, but I still had to crack the nut on how we go ahead and get these files from there. Well, it's supposed to be QuickTime files. I got QuickTime. Everybody, I think, has got QuickTime. I even went ahead and bought the Pro 7, but it would not open those files. So I thought, okay, I know what to do. So I went ahead, got back on there, clicked on it to save to my desktop, saved it to my desktop. It went through one of the Microsoft programs, appeared on my desktop, Then I just clicked it, create a PDF file, so I created the file. And that was some very interesting reading. But it also tied into the other stuff I saw, so I went through DTAC and got the rest of the information that they'd let me have. And I'm still pushing to try to get some more information. Also, NASA had some information on it, but I also found out I started off with Mach 27. And there's indications that these craft actually attain that speed.
Now, that's pretty fast.
Yes, sir. Also, if you'll note when you see the pictures, there is no heat shield on these craft. And they were going out in space. They were carried into space. They were what they called a boost glider type craft. They would actually circumvent the globe three times, then start re-entry in the Earth's atmosphere, which they'd go around several more times, taking fantastic pictures, skipping the Earth's atmosphere. Which means in 55-56 time frame, had we funded the program to do it, we would have had the first man in space. And it wouldn't just be a little ball sending back a beeping noise. But we chose not to do that. It wasn't until we got concerned with Sputnik that we decided, you know, we better get out there too. We were working on it, but it was still something that was considered, we can put it on the back burner. It didn't get its boost till after the Russians put Sputnik up.
Now, when we talk about Wright-Patterson, anything going on there now?
At Wright-Patterson?
Yeah.
I think so, yes, sir.
You do?
I definitely believe.
I mean, there's all kinds of stories about what's happened in the past, and probably most of it's true, I think.
Oh, yes, sir.
And so, they're a big story these days as well. We moved all that stuff out of there in the 80s. They probably didn't.
Let me give you an example. When UFOs first started, when we first started to investigate UFOs, and the public knew we were doing it, but didn't know what, because it was supposed to be secret. It was above secret. Army CIC was doing it. Once again, CIC's Counterintelligence Corps.
Yeah, right.
They gathered files. They kept the most...
I had a discussion with a guy of the Air Force. Oh, I see. And I said, well, I think the Army really was doing a lot more than everybody thinks. And he agreed with me. I think the Army was kind of hidden here, but they were right in the middle of it.
Well, Army
probably leading.
Well, we had the file on what happened here at Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what a lot of people don't know, do you know the Roswell file actually showed up in the Blue Book files and was there for a longest period of time?
Oh, really?
But people don't go back and read that stuff, the files. As a matter of fact, some of the files even got lost, even got destroyed, because after the Project Sign report came out, we were not going to investigate UFOs anymore. Something happened here in New Mexico that actually caused Grudge to come into existence.
What was that?
The Green Fireball phenomenon.
Okay. Now, I remember the Green Fireball story. They were,
yes, sir.
They still hear about it.
Oh, yes, sir. And they are still just mysterious. Project Twinkle was inconclusive.
Okay.
La Paz went to his death stating these were manufactured devices.
By us, probably.
Well.
Or somebody.
The technology we didn't have at that time.
Okay.
But now remember, Project Sign said, page 7 and 8, I think it is, on Project Sign. It stated, we look very closely at the possibility of these things being interplanetary spacecraft. We have a report done by Dr. Lipp of the RAM Corporation that says the least probability of the explanation of unidentified flying objects is interplanetary spacecraft. We will not in the future entertain or accept them as interplanetary spacecraft. You will not go that route. From that time on, they didn't. From that time on, if you worked in the aerial phenomena branch there at Wright-Patterson, it was a dead-end street. You were on your way out of the service. I don't know anybody that made a promotion or went further into their careers after they became head of Blue Book, Grudge, sign, forget it, because during the period of sign, the whole reason for doing that and making it clear in that report that you won't even consider interplanetary as an explanation was the, well, everyone calls it the top secret estimate of the situation. It was actually what we call a situation estimate. I've only seen one that's ever been released. But the situation UFOs, the estimate, they were interplanetary. Well, the Air Force went ahead and devised a system called bait and switch. You tell me what you saw. I will go ahead and put the other pieces in there, because what you're telling me what you saw may have been a structured craft, circular, and you were 15 feet away from it. Now, I'm going to put the pieces in there where you were suffering from war hysteria. You saw a helicopter land maybe 30 feet away from you, and your imagination took over. Now, why am I doing that? Not because I don't believe you, but I'm under orders to reduce the number of unknowns. During the time of Project Sign, 35% of the UFOs reported were unknown. They were reported
UFOs
by
reported were unknown.
Reliable.
They were reported UFOs
by
reported were unknown.
Reliable.
They were reported UFOs
by You know, that can't be. You're telling me a fantastic story. Well, that's how Hynek got it. Fantastic, that he was hearing fantastic stories being told, or how was it? Fantastic stories being told by highly credible people. It couldn't be ignored. He even had a frustration with the Air Force. In Bismarck, what is it, South Dakota?
Mm-hmm.
Bismarck, South Dakota, August 6, 1953. UFOs are being picked up by the ground observers, being picked up on radar, and the decision is made, send fighters up. Find out what these things are. Fighters went up. The UFOs took evasive action to avoid the fighters. The fighters saw them, would try to close in on them. They'd let them get close, then they'd take off. Even with the fighters hitting the afterburners, the fighters couldn't get close to them. 200 miles away, they started to see the same thing, only the evasive action wasn't being taken, probably because no fighters were sent up that time. I mean, if you can't do it, you can't do it. Mm-hmm. Why burn the fuel?
Mm-hmm.
So they went ahead and hit up on this. Hynek was scared to death in his report. They wrote for him. Says, you know, we give credence to this era of mystery in the in our investigation of UFOs. Take, for example, the Bismarck, South Dakota case, in which for 6 hours we had objects being seen, fighters going up to try to intercept them, being picked up on radar. And we cannot explain it. When some UFO researcher gets a hold of that, then we're going to be hard-pressed to explain what happened there. So he made it clear we need to go back and check these cases that are a year, 2 years, 3 years old and try to explain them. Well, we did. And it wasn't important that the explanation be right. Just get it off the books as as an unknown. What you wanted to do is reduce your number of unknowns. So he couldn't understand why no one took a picture, why they didn't send somebody out there to investigate, trained scientists who would have known what they were looking at. And, you know, this didn't make any sense to him. And also, he alluded to, you know, this could give the enemy the upper hand. In other words, the enemy could start bombing us, and all you have to do is go ahead, have some fifth columnists say, hey, I saw a UFO last night, get the adrenaline rushing, have another people start misidentifying stars, things of this sort, cause hysteria, bomb. Well, the bombing and all this would be taking place. You would not even anticipate that it's the Soviets or say, we're not doing that. But what happens? Everybody thinks ET's attacking. So after 2 or 3 days of this, well, you have a problem. And, you know, the morale is shot. No one has confidence in their military. And you've lost the war before it even begun. He actually put that in his assessment.
It was in there.
Now, what do you do about that case, which it took evasive action, picked up on radar, was being seen by many people? Well, you go ahead and you say that there was malfunction in the radars and that what people were seeing were temperature inversions. Now, I'm willing to accept that the day that somebody comes in and scientifically shows me that temperature inversions will take evasive action from fighter aircraft.
Good point. Sergeant Stone, we'll be right back and wrap this up. We're almost out of time. I want to ask you about this other CD that you have out. Don't go away.
I'm Jim Mars, author of Alien Agenda, the world's top-selling nonfiction book on UFOs. I'm here today to tell you one of the most fascinating stories I've come across in my career as a journalist. The secret of Reggate is that so many people in one small American community now know that there is so much more to the universe than what we see and experience in our everyday world.
Save $5 this month when you purchase The Secret of Reggate DVD from ShopJerryPippin.com. This film won the prestigious People's Choice Awards at the 2004 UFO Conference. The Secret of Reggate will astound you. You will want to see it again and again. Save $5. Order it now this month only at ShopJerryPippin.com. Secret of Reggate, a Linda Cowan production. We're in Roswell, and we're talking to Clifford Stone, who became a resident of Roswell through government obfuscation, I guess. They wouldn't let you move. welcome back. Let's talk about this other CD you have.
Well, I have a...
You have another one that's just released.
I have four.
Yeah, all together.
Yes, sir. The other one...
new one first.
Yes, sir. That one is the... New Mexico and UFOs, the early years, 1947 to 1952. You find out a whole lot about the green fireball phenomena. Also, you find out that the only state in the Union during the tenure of Project Blue Book that had its own Blue Book file was New Mexico. Yes, sir.
A state operation.
Well, a file within the Blue Book files just marked New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was telling you earlier, I actually believe that the death throbs would have been felt with the conclusions of Project Sign in February of 1949, in which the Air Force would have gladly have gotten out of the UFO business. And if you reported UFOs, we're sorry, if you feel threatened, notify your local law enforcement agency. We don't investigate UFOs anymore. Had it not been for Dr. Lincoln LaPaz seeing his green fireball and being an expert in the field, knew that that was something that was manufactured and exhibiting technology that was above and beyond anything that we had. Being concerned that it could be some type of espionage device directed against the security of the United States, he brought it to the attention of the military. The military was having their own problems with it, too.
All through this discussion we've had with you, it seems to me that the overriding concern was the security of the United States and the Cold War.
Yes, sir.
If all of these things, the UFO sightings, and all this had happened in a different climate, we might have a different outcome as far as disclosure.
Actually, we don't know that. Now, the reason I state that, there was a workshop that NASA had in the year 2000. Everybody quotes the Brookings Institute as to what they had to say. Well, in the year 2000, the Astrophysiology Department of NASA had a workshop. One of the concerns that they had was to let people know we're not alone in the universe when we have that first contact. They also, because of the entering into the advanced propulsion systems now and recognizing the fact that we may someday be able to visit other solar systems outside of our own, they may be able to come here. And the big concern is what world reaction would be. They believe religion is resilient enough that it would survive. There would not be a problem there. But once again, there would be many questions that would be brought up about the scientific community. It would be day one of school all over for most of the scientific community.
So in other words, you're saying we talk about the religious implications.
Yes, sir.
But you're saying the scientific implications were probably just as overriding because these were scientists and they were trying to cover their own...
Correct, sir. The other thing that's interesting about that report is that it makes it clear the clock is ticking. The day is approaching that we're going to have open contact. And the question is, how do you tell a world society? You and I might be able to accept extraterrestrial visitors, life out there in the cosmos, but there's a whole lot of people that aren't. They are concerned about the people who will take their lives, and there will be turmoil, particularly if that life shows up here, because most people fear the unknown. And they're going to perceive it as a threat. And I'd like to say...
That's always been one of the... I didn't mean to interrupt, and I'll let you say what you're going to say. But that's always been one of the concerns I've had. If the ETs wanted to make a friendly visit, we'd probably misread it. We'd think they were attacking us or something.
Well, from the military viewpoint, we would definitely want to go ahead and acquire the technology. But, you know, most of us see them as cartoon characters. We don't stop to think. They have societies like us. They have loves, they have likes, they have dislikes. They even have disagreements. But they're explorers. They're not warriors. Can they defend themselves? Oh, they could reduce us to a burned-out cinder. But that's not what they're about. Someday we're going to be space travelers too. But the only way that's going to happen is for us to leave our warlike ways here on this planet and start exploring the cosmos with the enthusiasm and the zeal of a child. We want to get out there and find out things about our universe for the knowledge, not for the destruction and detriment of the human species.
In your research in your military life and after your military life, have you seen evidence of contact?
Oh, yes, sir.
Has it always been friendly?
There have been some instances in which we would go ahead and identify some of it as being hostile, but we were always the aggressors.
Right. That's when we tried to shoot them down and they wouldn't.
One story I'd like to tell you about, but I get too emotional when I do it, but the reason... See, when you're telling the story, you see it in your...
Yeah.
You see it. You're reliving it. Inside of you, you're reliving it.
Yeah, well, I'd like to hear it if you could do it. I don't want to put you through a lot, but...
Well, there was one case where, and I've told this one before, but we were entertaining when he was supposed to be our guest. He was our prisoner. We don't keep him. They get him back. As soon as there's a crash, just like we do, there's... an effort to try to recover him. But I was gifted or cursed with this situation that I was sensitive to things. So I was used what they call interfacing a lot. And it's pretty much like you and I talk. As a matter of fact, I would try to talk because I wasn't used to conversing that way. But with the ETs, you would go ahead and you would feel what they were feeling.
And so not only did you hear a voice in your head, you felt their emotion.
Everything. They felt what you felt, and particularly when you got a companion. That was a person that pretty much follows you through life. And what that's all about, I don't know to this day, but I know it happens. Anyhow, we had this one room, and... they had this entity in there, and I was supposed to go in and get what I could.
I know this is painful. I apologize, but
I went in, and it looked up at me, and exact words: "I am afraid," and I felt what it was feeling, and trying to get it out a little further, you know. Think of you being billions of miles from home, not knowing if you're going to see your family again, your loved ones, or your own world. and we helped it get away.
You the people there?
Well,
not officially.
Me and another Spec 5.
Yeah, okay.
But it almost didn't happen. But
so you helped it escape?
Yes.
And what kind of ET was this?
This one was like an ash gray, and it was about 4.5-5 foot tall.
Had it been involved in a crash or something?
I didn't have a need to know that, but I believe that's what happened.
And probably he had lost other companions.
And, well, he said that his people was coming to get him.
Okay.
But there was a problem. In order to get him where we were at, they would have to take life, and they wasn't going to do that. So we knew we had to get him outside. If we got him outside, no one would be hurt. And
so you took him out of the compound?
We took him more just out of the compound. It had barbed wire around the compound. And we went ahead and cut the wire. Oryk didn't know what was going on. But he got to see it. There was other people that I served with that knew there was something strange about me, that I wasn't just the atypical 71 Lima. It happened to work in this office or that office.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a couple places where I was supposed to be the NCO. Well, at one time I was supposed to have been the NCOIC of Army Community Services at Fort Bliss. I was never the NCOIC of Army Community Services at Fort Bliss. I can produce the orders that says I was.
Yes.
But I was never that.
Far from that.
Oh, yes, sir.
And this being, did it thank you?
We had an understanding.
Okay.
If you have a family,
you could identify.
You could identify with what was going on there.
I think that's a good way to end the show. We'll talk to you again. Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found that although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road. And I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking, so well researched. Colonel X, come from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. The e-book of the century, now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com.
One of our special people from Fate Magazine here. We talked to you in Eureka Springs, and now here we are in Roswell, New Mexico. A little different here.
Yes, that's right. It's fun to make the circuit, but it's much hotter here, and the wonderful desert air, and all the excitement with the aliens in Roswell, the great parade, all the people, the movers and shakers are here.
And the Fate Magazine in September has an issue out, should be out any time now, I guess, about UFOs, right?
Well,
or is it October?
Typically it's our September issue, but there's been so much happening in the UFO world now that our July issue is almost dedicated to ufology also. The Mexican lights that happened down in Mexico, and there was some information in Iran about some sightings. John Greenwald, who is a bright and upcoming star, has written about his Black Vault, his freedom of information.
So you have he's here in Roswell
this weekend
as well.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to hurry along because you have an appointment with a movie producer here in a minute.
Well, coming up pretty close, yes.
And what's that about? I mean, Fate, is that going to be a TV show, you think?
Well, we're real excited to announce that we've signed a contract with Yellow Hat Productions, a Hollywood production company, for a proposed pilot and possible series of stories from Fate magazine to be on television.
And you're having meetings again with them tonight.
That is correct.
And so this is a work in progress, and we wish you a lot of luck. I've always thought, you know, there's thousands of stories in that magazine.
Exactly.
They'd make a great little series like Unsolved Mysteries or something.
That's
like
right,
that.
Or Twilight Zone. I mean, there's 56 years of stories. There is literally thousands of wonderful stories.
Now, you sneaked away today and went down to Carlsbad Cavern.
Yes.
Am I letting out a secret when I mention that? Or is that
an expense account?
No. That's a pretty impressive place, I understand.
It was just absolutely mind-boggling. And I always try to kind of psychically tune in when I visit sacred places like this. And, of course, there's so many people in Carlsbad. There's just people coming all the time. But it was so interesting because everyone spoke in a very quiet, reverential voice. It was like being in a library or church. Everyone spoke with hushed voices. And I was disappointed at myself because I couldn't feel anything psychically there. And then I thought to myself, well, gee, rocks, the earth, it's very slow. So I was just moving at too fast a pace. I just had to slow down, and it's like the rocks were actually speaking. They were just kind of laughing, like the Ents in Tolkien. Very, very slow, because they take thousands of years to form.
Now, they have quite a lighting configuration down there. It makes it impressive, I understand.
Yes, it is just, it beggars description. It's just beyond comprehension, the grandeur of our world.
You've had countless stories in Fate magazine over the years about underground caves and caverns and people coming out of things, I'm sure.
I know. We were being kind of silly today, saying that we didn't see any Darrows, the stories in Fate, or any creatures or elementals or elves or dwarves coming out of the earth. We figured they were all hiding today because of the excessive number of people.
You know, when we talk about that, there's all kinds of fables and stories, and people swear they're true, and I don't know if they are or not, about these the little creatures you find in these caves, and sometimes they're not so little.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does anything come to mind about any of these stories about caves that you can think of off the top of your head?
Well, there's been so many stories recorded about entities living under the earth from thousands of years ago, so I guess I would tend to believe that something must be behind it, because people can't make up these stories from all different cultures unless there's some foundation for it.
New Mexico is kind of it's called the Land of Enchantment. That's the state slogan. It's kind of a different place. Like, it's fairly desolate here in Roswell, but you didn't have to go too far south to see completely, totally different country.
Right, right. It was just beautiful, beautiful country. The desert is a whole different world. And then we visited another part of the Chihuahuan Desert, and it was a rock overhang where you walk down off the road here about an eighth of a mile, and they said prehistoric people lived there. They had found shards from arrowheads and stone tools and things. So it's like, I just had to wonder, who predated the Native Americans? What kind of people were here? Where did they come from? What did they look like? And you could almost feel the activity in this overhang and in this cave kind of thing in the rocks.
Fate magazine, of course, now may become a TV show. We wish you luck on that. You've been around for a while. It's available at newsstand.
Yes.
And you have your own website.
And people can email us for a free sample copy. Just log on to our website, fatemag.com, and there's a place for a free issue.
Roswell stories, they abound here as well, of course, from the fable crash in 1947. And, of course, when you arrive on a holiday weekend like this, you see all kinds of ETs everywhere, but I have a hunch they're not the real thing. When we come back, we'll talk to her about a couple of other incidents, and then we'll let you go sign your movie deal. Well, you've already signed it. You're just going
to
be a little visiting, right?
A little negotiating.
Okay, we'll be right back. This is Jerry Pippin. This is the UFO Files. Well, we're visiting with one of our favorite friends. You're actually the editor and publisher.
That's correct.
And of Fate Magazine. And you also did a little bit of the Old West tour, I think, also. Did you see a ghost town or something?
That's right. We went up to see the little small town of Lincoln, and that's where Billy the Kid helped take care of something in the Lincoln County Wars. And he was actually shot near there. He escaped from the jail up there. The whole town is like a historic site, and it's wonderful old buildings from the middle 1800s. And I actually felt some ghostly chills when I was up in the jail where Billy the Kid was held. And I just kind of innocently asked the receptionist there, the historical lady at the front desk in this old courthouse, and I asked, you know, anybody ever experience any ghosts around here? And she says, yes. She says, people have seen things in the stairway where Billy the Kid shot at one of the deputies down the stairway, and his bullet hole is still there. And one of the ladies that worked there went down the stairs, and someone else followed her down the stairs, only there was no one there. And they have felt chills and had various experiences. They've had paranormal investigators come there and have sensed things. There is a ghost in the old hotel there. A woman in room 3 saw a cowboy undressing in there when she was staying in there. And she actually came back and wanted to stay in the same room again.
Cause that must have been quite a cowboy.
Yeah. Very handsome. I'm jealous. And in the mercantile store, there's another female ghost that has been seen several times. So the whole town, it has to be haunted with all the deaths there, because in the Lincoln County Wars, they were just killing each other right and left.
Yeah, I mean, it literally was the shoot 'em up Old West.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
In every sense of the word. And there's quite the controversy going on whether or not they're going to run DNA tests on Billy the Kid's body or not, and I don't think the people in that town necessarily want it to happen. They've got a good thing going the way
exactly,
it is right now.
Exactly, yes. Well, I guess Billy the Kid does have a daughter. I mean, they've done DNA testing, and he did have an illegitimate child.
And so we don't know whether Pat Garrett really killed him or not. I have a hunch he probably did.
I think he did, yes.
And probably not quite the way Pat told it either. Probably there was an ambush or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, they ambushed him in a house.
Yeah. And I guess that's one of the prerequisites for most of these ghost stories, as we've talked to you before. There has to be a violent type
of
action usually.
Yes.
Or a huge emotional attachment. You talked about that as well.
I think so, yes. For a ghost to stick around, usually there's some agony or discomfort or a score to settle, and they just stick around. Sometimes, however, they just like the area. Sometimes I think they're the guardians of an area if it's a benevolent kind of ghost.
It's interesting. Okay, now you're psychic. You have some psychic ability. You pick up anything about extraterrestrials when you're here in Roswell.
It's pretty quiet now, and actually it's so frenetic, and it's such, I mean, kind of a wonderful carnival atmosphere, and everyone's having so much fun, so it's really hard to tune into it.
So you don't really get any vibe one way or the other?
No, not yet this year. But learning all the facts and all the information that is presented about Roswell, it's so obvious there was an incredible government cover-up about it. It's just like, how stupid do they think we are?
Well, they think we're pretty stupid, evidently.
Yes, all the stories they tell, the government has tried to put this to rest, but...
Well, you know, it's a pleasure seeing you again, and I tell you, your magazine, it gets better and better all the time, and you've put us on your mailing list, and we do appreciate that.
Okay.
And that's the reason I confused this issue that I just got in the mail with the September issue, which is UFOs, because there's some UFOs in this issue, the July issue.
Yes. There's just, like I said, there's so much things happening in the world now, and ufology and sightings and all kinds of experiences, so we just felt it was important to be up to date.
Any story you're working on your way? I mean, you drove down here from Minnesota,
that's
right?
That's correct, yes.
It was a fast trip, I'm sure, but maybe you'll run across something on the way back.
We plan to do a little sightseeing tourism.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, good. You never know where you'll find the next ghost story. But you deal a lot of things at Fate Magazine, not just the ghost story by itself, but quite a few other things as well. I would recommend that they go to the website. That's the best way, really, to get a taste of what's happening.
That's right. A lot of ghost stories, life after death, Bigfoot, strange archaeology, spirituality, life after death.
These mountains in New Mexico and Arizona are filled with spirituality, too.
Very much so. There's lots of strange vibes. Lots of wonderful things and heartbreaking things have happened in these hills.
Well, I'm really glad that you stopped by, and we look forward to running across you again soon. And folks, I cannot recommend this magazine enough, Fate Magazine. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the UFO Files. We're in Roswell, New Mexico. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we have a fellow from Hawaii here, John Hamerick. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
You're going to have to get a little closer to that mic, John. You came all the way from Hawaii, or were you already over here?
Well, actually, I recently moved to Nevada, so...
Well, that's in one way it's similar, it's warm, but in another way it's totally different.
Right. I actually like the dry weather a little bit better than the humidity.
Now, you have a website, and I want you to give it on the air, and we have a link to it as well. First of all, give the website, then tell me a little bit about what this is all about, what you do.
Okay, the website is www.etx2.org.
And what's it about?
It's basically about the UFO phenomenon, the concept of extraterrestrials, and how it relates to the Bible and paranormal activity.
Now, when you got interested into this subject, and you probably had an interest all your life, I take it, was the Bible part of it from the beginning?
Well, yeah, it actually was. I'll give you a little bit history of my testimony on how I got involved in this. But I started out pretty young. I was probably about 6 or 7 years old in eastern Montana, where I grew up in a small town.
So you grew up in Montana, from birth or what?
Yeah, I was born in a town called Billings, and then I grew up in a smaller town in eastern Montana. And how I got involved in the UFO phenomenon started when I used to have like sleepwalking type experiences. And I'm not even really sure if it was sleepwalking, but I would sometimes find myself in the middle of the night, like half a block away from my home.
Wow. That is walking.
Yeah, and so...
That's sleep traveling.
Right. And I knew something was terribly wrong, and it really bothered me, and UFOologists today probably would say, some of them would say I was probably having abduction experiences. I'm not really sure what was happening to me, but I just knew it was bad. And I wanted it to end, and I would have nightmares, typical child that might think a monster's under the bed, etc., something like that. And then over time, and through some other experiences that I was involved in, and really thinking hard about the spirit realm and why I'm here, where am I going, what am I, you know, the typical questions people ask, philosophical questions, ask them. So I was asking those questions to myself when I was really young. And it got to a point where I didn't really want to live anymore. I was really, really bothered, and I was trying to figure out what life's all about. And I was introduced to the biblical gospel, and I used to go to church with my parents, to the Catholic Church, and I'd see the crucifix up on the wall, and I was trying to figure out what this was all about. And I was told that that's God, who died for me. And eventually, one day when I was lacking a tremendous amount of sleep, I chose to just surrender. I didn't understand it. It really, the concept of hell really bothered me, that anyone could go there. And eventually I just had to surrender that there was a good God, and he had it all under control, and this Jesus who died on the cross, he died for me, and then my sleepwalking went away. And I didn't do that anymore. I didn't have the nightmares anymore.
Literally everything changed for you.
Yeah, my whole life changed, except, and then also that night, though, I had some type of spiritual incident where I was actually had some type of a visitation.
Yeah, visitation from an angel or what?
Well, here's the thing. I remember remembering what had happened, but this was in the past. And then somehow the memory was actually, like, blacked out. It was actually, like erased out of my memory.
You don't feel you were ever abducted, right?
No, I don't feel...
I mean, you have all of the symptoms, as you said.
Right. Well, the sleepwalking experiences was a type of abduction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one way or the other, something was taking over my body and doing something strange. And mm-hmm. I'd find myself half a block away in the middle of the night in my bare feet.
Now, I didn't mean to interrupt you on the train of thought on what you were talking about. We're talking about this incident now, or maybe it was incidents where you were visited correctly.
Right, and then, but my life had changed, and my focus now was on the Bible and reading the Bible and, you know, praying and worshiping this person called Jesus. But something had happened to me where, for some reason or another, I had an interest in the UFO phenomenon, and part of that...
Now, you weren't interested in the UFOs before your conversion.
Well, maybe I was. Maybe I saw a few program shows
and they interested
me, but now it really interested
now
me.
Now, all of a sudden, it becomes a mission or an impulse.
Right.
It's compulsive.
Yeah, and I used to watch a lot of Star Trek shows,
mm-hmm.
and I can distinctly remember watching this one... Star Trek show called Bread and Circuses, and that one had to do with the Star Trek Enterprise had beamed down to this planet, and it was kind of like the Roman days, but in the 20th century or 21st century, where they had TV crews and everything like that, and in that time period when the Star Trek Enterprise crew was down on this planet. They experienced something similar to what happened during the Roman times on Earth, where there was actually a Jesus who came and died for the sins of that planet.
I think I remember that episode.
Okay, yeah, it was probably a pretty popular episode.
Mm-hmm.
And they even had videotaped kind of like the Colosseum, you know, where they used to persecute the Christians. They were doing that, but since it was in a time where they had TV film crews, they were actually filming it. Filming the persecutions.
I think it's interesting you bring up that particular episode because, if I remember correctly, there was a lot of controversy about whether or not this was anti-Christian or pro-Christian, this whole concept. But you, it had a positive effect on.
Well, it had both a positive and a negative effect. I wouldn't even say it's negative effect. But it got me really thinking about the concept of redemption and you know, did Jesus really have, if there are other planets with other beings, does Jesus have to go to all those other planets and die over and over again?
Which is a pretty normal question that people have that are religious that no one ever addresses in the UFO field.
Right. Well, actually, fortunately, they did today.
Okay.
In this Ancient of Days conference that I was just at
mm-hmm.
in Roswell, New Mexico. But this really bothered me. I was really young, and I saw this as a problem within Christianity, that chances are Jesus wouldn't do this, and that when Adam and Eve, when Adam sinned, now I should tell you that I believe in I'm a creationist.
Okay.
And even though I have a science degree, I have a chemical engineering degree. And my involvement in the UFO phenomenon probably has damaged my career greatly. But anyways, going back to the movie, the movie shook me up a lot. And then it made me think that Jesus didn't have to do this over and over again, so there's something wrong here, even though Gene Roddenberry probably believed this was a possibility. That's why he wrote it. And then probably a few years later, I had a friend, a close friend of mine, whose father was an FBI investigator. And in Montana, eastern Montana and Montana area, there was a lot of cattle mutilations happening.
Okay. Right.
And we used to drive on these long roads. You'd drive 100 miles and not see a car, and you'd kind of have these weird thoughts about, you know, maybe you'd run into a UFO or you'd see a mutilated cow. And I even heard stories that I had an uncle who had some mutilated cows on his ranch. And after talking to my friend for a little while, he had told me that his father, who investigated these cattle mutilations, had a number of conclusions, and one of them was that it was possibly UFOs that were involved. Okay, so this just perked my interest, and I decided to study the UFO phenomenon even more. And also reading the Bible and learning about prophecy and eschatology, I thought maybe the UFO phenomenon could be involved in some deceptive acts where it could deceive some of the Bible prophecies or be involved with some of the Bible prophecies.
And what's your opinion on that today?
Well, so that led me to eventually get more and more involved, and I ended up moving to Hawaii, where I and that was a job move for an engineering, and I ended up quitting that job because the project fell through that I was working on, and that was to convert sugarcane bagasse into paper pulp. And so since that project failed, I quit that project, and I decided to give a UFO talk in Hawaii. So I gave a 3-week talk on UFOs in the Bible. And
so you had a meeting every night or something, you mean?
It was one meeting.
That lasted 3 weeks?
Three weeks, not every night. It was once.
Yeah.
Once
okay, per okay, week. Okay, gotcha. Yeah. I was going to say, surely you gave us a lunch break.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I found that I had a lot of difficulty getting the church involved, especially the pastors. For some reason, this is a topic that they don't like to touch very much. But I managed to get an assistant pastor interested enough that he allowed me to do this through this particular church. And the pastor did not want to talk about it. He didn't give the message to the congregation that I was giving this conference, but he allowed me to put a flyer in for a couple weeks. So I didn't think anybody was going to show up. I thought maybe just a couple people were going to show up, some of my friends, because they felt sorry for me. And ended up...
I imagine from the interviews I've done on this subject, you actually had a fairly large crowd show up.
Exactly. It was standing room only in this one house.
Mm-hmm.
And there was people from all... There were scientists, PhDs. They just came out of the woodwork. It was pretty amazing. And the conference went very well. And I should say, too, that it's kind of interesting because I had a girlfriend at the time who was kind of like a fiancé. We were planning to get married, and she was in the mainland U.S., and she had called me probably just a day before the conference and said she was going to break up with me. So that added to a little difficulty, but I decided to still do the conference.
Well, you know, as they say, and I'm not saying what you did was a show, but the show must go on, so when you make these meetings and you schedule them, you have to show up.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on with the conference, and I categorized it into three categories: the evolution of the alien concept, and the arts and aliens, which is how the movies, how movies, the theater,
how they deal with it,
music, right? Everything, how they deal with that, and how it's grown over the years, and how that's influencing basically, you know, everybody in the Western world to believe in the alien concept. And then from there I went into the reality of the UFO phenomenon, the reality of abductions, whether they're actually physical or not, they're really happening, and then into how that's related to the Bible.
Well, when you say physical or not, it's still really happening. What do you mean? As far as they're concerned, it is a reality. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I mean, whether it's happening in the mind or it's happening physically,
mm-hmm.
it's really happening to them. I mean, I'm sure some of the people aren't, you know, might not be telling the truth, but the vast majority of them are really having experiences.
Yeah, I take it from the conversation we're having, and we've never met before, but I take it that you assume that, and you believe, and you are intent on improving, if you can, that the ET experiences are not extraterrestrials at all, but maybe something else. Or do you believe in extraterrestrials as well?
Well, I see that as it's a possibility that... Now, you have to keep in mind that I'm a theist, so I believe that there's a God, an
yes.
all-powerful, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent
right.
God, and he's the one that created the universe. Now, he could have created other beings on other planets, but you run into problems with that. And some of the biggest problems are when Adam and Eve sinned, it was supposed to affect the whole world negatively. In other words, entropy entered the whole universe, the whole cosmos. And so just try to imagine a planet where nobody fell in another solar system in another galaxy. And they're and all of a sudden they're dying and their hair's falling out and they're getting old and they don't know what's going on. And they might, you know, seek out God and say, what's going on? And then God says, well, way over on this other planet called Earth, a person by the name of Adam and Eve sinned, and that's causing you to die. See, that doesn't make any sense. So that's a big problem. And then there's other problems like, you know, Jesus having to go to planet to planet to planet to die over and over again. That's another serious problem.
So where are you at this point? I mean, you've been studying this topic for some time now. Where are you in the belief of UFOs and what people are seeing and feeling? Are they all demons or what?
Well, yeah, I lean that direction, and for a number of reasons, that the abduction phenomenon is generally causes trauma. It's generally evil. It's sinister. It's deceptive. Even the so-called good experiences have like negative gospels or negative messages against the Bible, and so putting all these together, I see, and also the aliens, their messages too are to produce a new world order that is in opposition to Jesus and his followers. And so, yeah, putting all those together, you would come to the conclusion that, demons could be involved.
We have to take a break. We'll be right back. And we're going to wrap up with a final segment. I've got a couple of questions I want to talk to you about and explore this a little more. I'm Jerry Pippin. This is UFO Files. Okay, now I want to do a six-minute segment.
Okay, so I'm trying to think... Oh, yeah, they talk a lot about disclosure today.
Yeah.
Which I have an interest in.
Okay. Okay, we'll get to that. John, we've got a couple of things I want to talk to you about what we've been talking about in the last segment. But first of all, before we get to that, disclosure, Stephen Bassett was a keynote speaker here at this particular conference. And he's been pushing for that. What are your thoughts about this disclosure issue? The government, is there anything to disclose? Do they know things? What do they know? What's your theory about it?
Well, yeah, definitely. If you listen to a number of the speakers today, they had lots of evidence showing that the government is definitely hiding something, not just our government, but other governments. And one of the reasons they're doing it is because of the Brookings Report. In other words, the Brookings Report is saying that it could cause, and probably will cause, some type of social chaos, religious chaos within the world.
Well, that's one reason I'm asking you, because you already mentioned you're a creationist. You mentioned you're fairly fundamentalist, I would say.
Right, right. And I want to change subjects.
But at the same time, you're obviously an educated man and a scientific man, and you've been studying the subject, so you somehow put it all together to be able to live with it, and I'm trying to find out why and how.
Okay. Well, going back to my creationism studies, I want to say one thing that I'm a person that's affected me a lot in understanding the cosmos and starlight and time, which seems
there are many people who think that this planet
people in trying to understand creationism. I would hold to this theory by Dr. Humphreys on starlight and time, and I recommend you can go to, you know, like Amazon.com and look up a book called Starlight and Time, and he also has a video.
So you're saying there is an answer to the question about, well, man's only 10 or 20,000 years old, and the rocks are a million years old. You're saying there's an answer for that?
Well, you see, I hold, there is an answer. There's actually a lot of answers.
You know, we could talk forever on this. This is a subject I love to discuss, just like politics, but unfortunately the time has got us. Check out your website. You're going to get a book out, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm working on a book right now, and it's related to everything I've been talking about.
This is Jerry Pippin. Thanks for listening. We're in Roswell, New Mexico. Our producer's been Roberta Scott. Until next time, cheers.
Charles Giuliani. I mentioned a couple weeks ago when I talked about the subject of
coming cataclysms. Gordon Giannotto will be here with us in just a few minutes.